This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future. WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
It's Friday, gang. That is when we gather around and dig into the biggest news stories of the week. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset.
A charismatic and calm Mike Madigan was on the stand for more than 4 hours.
Madigan told jurors he knew nothing about how his allies landed no-work utility company contracts worth hundreds of thousands of dollars.
There's still no deal between Chicago Public Schools and the teachers union.
The eventual agreement must be aligned with our strategic plan. It must be financially sustainable. And if we overextend ourselves today, it will be our children and staff that pay the price tomorrow.
The disappointment is that we should already be done. We're almost halfway through the school year.
There's a lot to get to, so I called in a few friends to help. Amanda Vinicky is a correspondent for WTTW's Chicago Tonight and the host of Chicago Tonight Week in Review. Revy Baishwal is anchor of ABC7's 5 and 6 p.m. newscasts. And Nader Issa is education reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times. Now, things are heating up in the corruption trial of former House Speaker Michael Madigan. This week, he waived his right not to testify and took the stand in his own defense. So Amanda started us off with just what we learned from his testimony.
I mean, first of all, it was shocking that he made that choice, given just his sort of general recalcitrance to speak to the press
speak.
And be right. And not that that never happened, but just not often. I am, that said, not wholly surprised, because my read of this, he hasn't told me so, is that he really believes he didn't do anything wrong and that this is all sort of a witch hunt. And so he wants to have his say. Maybe also he is 82. This is partially appearing as sort of a genial grandfather. We learned some about his upbringing. He hasn't talked about, I mean, the times that I have interviewed him or that he was before the press talking, particularly during the stalemate that the state underwent when you had a Republican governor and Democrats in control of the legislature, was talking just about policy. Here we learned that he had a father who had problems with alcohol, but who nonetheless really enforced on him the importance of hard work and diligence.
Right.
And those are things that you heard about throughout the testimony. So I think that was a major takeaway. Other big takeaways were his just flat out denial of many of the allegations. He said, no, I would not be involved in a quid pro quo. So those are, I think, some of the real big ones.
Well, another notable thing that came up, Madigan said he and co-defendant Michael McLean, they're no longer friends.
Yeah, he said that they'd stayed friends from their days in the legislature up until now. We don't know what broke things. Again, just as somebody who has followed Madigan for my entire career, but just really a portion of his, given how that he is the longest serving legislative leader in the United States. He still holds that record. But that he's really perturbed by the emails that came across, in which, if you are to believe Madigan at his testimony, McLean was doing a lot of bidding in the name of his, quote, friend, with a capital F there, as he was referred to, our friend,
right,
that he was doing a lot of work for Madigan without Madigan's knowledge. Mm. And I would presume that when that lands you in trial, that that is something that could break up a friendship, despite these really doting letters that we have seen that McLean wrote about Madigan.
Right.
I mean, you read them and it's sort of like, I am but an agent blessed to be in the presence of the almighty speaker. They're really over the top.
This doesn't even sound like real life. How do you think Madigan did on the stand this week, Revy?
Well, anyone who would take the stand in that kind of a situation, talking to legal experts, talking to friends who are lawyers, says that that means they think they're going to lose. And so their only hope here is to have a direct personal impact, if you will, on the jury, on those who are actually going to be in judgment. And when you talk about, Amanda, how long Michael Madigan has been on the on our radar forever, it seems, certainly long before I ever got here. People know who he is. People know that he's part of the fabric of Illinois politics, and his what appears to be heartfelt notion that this is essentially how business is done here, and the not quid pro quo, but sort of the give and take of politics, which reminds me kind of Rod Blagojevich's old defenses as well. And the bewilderment around that and that other people don't understand it working that way, it seems sincere from our reporting, and we'll see what that kind of impact is on the jury.
Yeah, well, next week, prosecutors will actually get their turn with Madigan. Amanda, what can we expect?
So we are going to expect things to get downright fierce, I am sure. I think there is that. And then there's also this tape that Madigan's defense team had thus far said, been able to block from being heard by the jury, that now, because he testified and sort of waded into this pool, the prosecution is now likely to be entering into evidence this tape in which Madigan talks about some of the folks, quote, making out like bandits. Oh. And so this could potentially undermine the notion that he didn't realize that some of the people who he'd recommended for posts were not doing anything in those jobs, despite getting paid. And so that, I think, is going to be one of the central arguments that prosecutors are going to seize on now that they have the ability to do so, hoping, I'm sure, that the jury finds that distasteful and illegal.
It'll be interesting to see what the jury thinks about that supposed illegal activity is relative to the supposed business that Madigan was able to get for his own law firm and the relationships that that were created, that had to be created so that he could get that kind of business. Which one is worse in terms of the public purse? I'll see what they think of that.
Nader, I'm curious, have you been following any of this trial at all? Because I know that you've also had your head in a lot of schools drama.
Yeah, I've been able to take in a couple nuggets, and I think something that stuck out to me as very relatable for people in Madigan's testimony was the little sort of side venture about his email and cell phone. And it's just been such a legend of Mike Madigan. Like, he doesn't use email, he doesn't have a cell phone.
Yeah, I found that strange,
and
too.
And he really waded into that and just said, look, I'm an older guy. I used to do all of my business before these things existed. Once they came on, I didn't really find a need to change. And I don't know, I could see some people saying, yeah, I have an older relative who's like that, or someone that...
It sounds relatable.
It sounds relatable.
I'm jealous.
Real.
I think it sounds... It is a privilege to be able to do that. You have to have a lot of power and, frankly, a lot of means to have somebody handling all of your calls, all of your emails. Here, I'll just pass you the important work. I would give up my phone.
It kind of does sound like a dream.
It sounds great.
Yeah. And to that end, too, I think it's a sign that you do have that power where you're somebody who people need to reach. You don't need the tools to reach other people. And I think that's something that has really sort of popped into my head as we listen to Mike Madigan.
So it's a power thing. Being ignorant of technology is actually a power thing.
I think so.
It is a huge power move.
Throughout this entire trial, it's all about power. I want to turn now to city politics. Revy, two alders, they want to change Chicago's sanctuary city rules that protect undocumented immigrants. Fill us in.
Yeah, this is going to be very interesting in the context of what may be coming down the pipe with the new administration in Washington. And we all know that that's President-elect Trump will become the president again on January 20th. So what, 10 days from now? Mm-hmm. And he is promising mass deportations. And so we have our welcoming sanctuary city ordinance here in the city that's been around for some 38 years. And what two alders are trying to do here is kind of weaken it a little bit, it seems, to be able to say, okay, we want to work with you, Trump administration, about who you might want to deport, and we will help by ensuring that this sanctuary city ordinance is somewhat weakened so that helps you go after people who are criminals and are undocumented here. And so we're talking about Alderman Ray Lopez in the 15th Ward and Alderperson Silvana Tavares in the 23rd. They're going to actually try this never tried before, this parliamentary move to try to change that ordinance, just soften it a little bit so that it will be easier for cooperation to happen between basically city police and ICE.
Force city council to vote on amending it.
Right, exactly. So, but the key thing here is to allow, you know, essentially Chicago police to help ICE find people who are not only undocumented but are also criminals. And so it seems to me there's some politics essentially going on here. Let's give them something that they can work with. And whether city council is going to go along with this, it'll be very hard to see.
Thoughts, Nader?
Yeah, I think something that's important here too is, and this is Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa pointed this out, it goes a little bit to removing due process for people, because the way that cooperation with ICE works is you hold people for an extra 48 hours once they've been arrested. They haven't had a trial. They haven't, you know, been able to prove whether they're guilty or not, or whether they're innocent or not, excuse me. And so they're labeled as criminals, but it's more so they've been accused of committing a crime.
Right.
And that's where ICE would come in.
Nothing's been proven yet. Yeah. Well, there could, in other news, be another battle. This is brewing in city council over aldermanic prerogative. And this involves a Lincoln Park development project, Ravi. What are the details there?
Well, again, we're back to the with Sterling Bay and other developers. They're one of the largest developers. They're looking to basically win approval for the 615-unit apartment complex in Lincoln Park. And this is going to be across the way from the giant Sterling Bay development that's in that same area. The local alderman, Scott Wagasback, 32nd Ward, he does not want this. And we've had this longstanding rule. It's an unwritten rule in city council that says that aldermanic privilege allows for a veto power over development, particularly over residential development in one's ward. Well, Scott Wagasback doesn't want it. He says it's too big, it's too dense, it's going to make traffic worse and all the rest of it. However, the mayor wants it as well. So does want it because
wants
affordable housing and it fits other parts of the strategic plan for the city of Chicago. So again, it comes down to some interesting parliamentary moves here. But basically the planning commission said it was okay. The zoning commission said it wasn't okay. But there's some little never used provision of the law, at least as it relates to city council, that says, well, that's okay. Planning wants it, zoning doesn't want it, we can take it straight to city council. So one of the mayor's big allies, Walter Burnett, is trying to do that. And so Wagasback is crying foul, saying that, hey, wait, what about aldermanic privilege? And by the way, I thought aldermanic privilege or prerogative, I thought we had done away with a lot of that during Lori Lightfoot's time. Had we not? It's back this much?
I guess so.
I mean, and I think this is going to be a big test because you're really seeing two issues come at loggerheads. The protection of this and really a emboldened city council where our alder people from sort of cross caucuses joined forces, have allegiances now over this battle fight, over the budget battle, that, and we'll see what they carry over. How much power did the mayor lose through his, again, budget battles and other sort of public missteps? And where does the affordable housing component come into play?
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to schools, Nader. Where are we with teacher contract negotiations?
I'm not sure.
Nowhere.
It's in a good place, yeah.
Nowhere.
Things have gotten...
I wish everyone saw that look on your face.
I was just going to say.
That
told us everything.
His shoulders
went back.
Things have been, we know over the past, you know, decade, things have been nasty at times, hostile. I mean, we remember there was like a 10 p.m. Sunday night news conference by Mayor Lori Lightfoot at the time, really, really going hard at the teachers union. Things just seem to be in a similarly toxic place right now. And it's all been muddied up by this conflict between the teachers union and the mayor, with Pedro Martinez, the CPS CEO, and the Board of Education. It's sort of in a place that we haven't seen before. There's a lawsuit by Martinez against the school board. So negotiations right now, they're sort of at a standstill.
Yeah, they're kind of like in the background.
They're inching along. Yeah, it's just I don't see how this is going to get resolved right now with all of these major areas of dispute between CPS and CTU.
So the mayor's come under additional scrutiny during the contract negotiations. This is for a potential conflict of interest. Can you explain?
Yeah, so this came to light during Martinez's lawsuit against the Board of Education. There's a memo that had been written a year ago by an official at CPS saying that the mayor, because he was working at the CTU before he became mayor, on leave from his CPS job as a teacher.
Okay.
He then left CTU, was elected mayor. He still remains technically on leave from CPS. And so the sort of perception
CTU.
From CTU, excuse me. So the perception of the conflict of interest is that, you know, when he's done being mayor, he still has a job on hold at CPS if he wants to go back to that. And it is CPS. It's that it's that he's on leave as
from
a teacher
CPS
from CPS
CTU.
So
okay.
that he could work for CTU. So there's like two levels
so it's a double
of
level.
Leave right now.
Yeah. Okay, pardon me.
There's this perception that should he right now help CTU land a really good contract that gives teachers big raises, once he's done being mayor, he could go back and have a classroom job waiting for him that would have a higher salary. He would benefit from the CTU contract in that way.
Ah, oh my goodness. Okay, sticking with Mayor John.
Controversy as well over how he handled it. That's sort of the other layer of things, I think, that...
The fifth layer.
Sure, right? I don't know what layer we're on right now, Ted. But that he had said that they sought an opinion from the city's ethics officer over this, although There really is no evidence of such. There are continued questions, not just about the situation, but as well how it is handled. And I think this continues a run of questions about transparency or communication.
Yeah. How is it communicated here? Exactly. Yeah. I mean, this double level, essentially, of a conflict of interest is remarkable. And that's, again, only in Chicago.
Mayor Johnson would also like the state to set aside more money for Chicago public schools. But Governor Pritzker, he had some harsh words this week about the mayor's efforts.
They don't reach out very often, and it seems like they don't have good relationships in Springfield, in part because they don't do the outreach that's necessary.
Here's another quick comment from the governor about Mayor Johnson and his staff.
With regard to his budget, literally the last call that we got from them was in September. And then once in December, we by the way, scheduled calls. And then they didn't show up.
Ouch. Now let's hear Mayor Johnson's perspective on all this.
We are working collaboratively, and we are in constant conversations with the state of Illinois, with the governor's team, with the leadership in Springfield.
Constant.
Give me all your thoughts here on how things are going between the governor and the mayor. It's just constant drama, if you ask me.
They ain't good. But up until this point, you had both sides putting forward, at least publicly, that everything was getting along fine and just great. So I think the fact that the governor made those comments, we shouldn't only take away what he said, but the fact that he said them so pointedly. I mean, that was a choice. It wasn't an offhand remark or an oops. That was a calculated maneuver that I think is the sign of true frustration that you're constantly hearing from the city of Chicago. And again, this is obviously coming from somebody who's covered the state house primarily, but that hears from the state of Chicago, we need this. We deserve all of this from the state, when the asks haven't, according to the Pritzker administration, been made. It also was after, I think, what was sort of an embarrassing defeat for the governor of a piece of legislation that he embraced in December.
Oh, you're talking about hemp.
In terms of hemp regulations. And so I know we can get to the hemp part itself later, but I think that the governor is somebody who does not like to lose. It's particularly to a mayor who has approval ratings that are frankly in the tank. Yeah. And so he also went on to say he doesn't believe that it was the mayor's lobbying that caused this hemp regulation measure to fail. I think that that is an accurate summation. It would have passed already had it been a non-controversial measure.
I think the issue also, and how a lot of people who watch politics closely see it, is that, again, this gap between the mayor and the governor in the Democratic firmament that is politics in Chicago and Illinois, that type of thing doesn't come out very often. And this is because everybody's presumably on the same team. And so for the governor, I think a lot of people have to take notice for the governor to make such a point of the difference. And what I read into it was kind of lack of style, lack of professionalism, lack of sophistication about how stuff gets done, which is one of the big arguments and problems with the Johnson administration right now, why they're suffering in terms of approval. So I think there was a little bit of a slap on the head, if you will, verbally from the governor.
Oh, for sure. New state lawmakers were sworn into office on Wednesday. So how's the year ahead looking in Springfield? Will Democrats and Republicans be working together any better than in the past? Well, here's Amanda.
This is the 104th General Assembly, just inaugurated. They have some big ticket items on the agenda, so we'll start with that. And that's something that has been talked about a lot, including by the Johnson administration. And those are things like trying to come forward with more money for both Chicago schools as well as other school districts. And then also what is going to happen to the Northeastern Illinois area's public transit systems, both asking for money and then what leaders, including the governor, have said has to come along with that is some sort of reform or systemic change. Yeah. So those are a couple of those. And oh, wait, on top of that, the state is looking at a deficit that's pegged to be at upwards of $3
billion. $3 billion. So how does Pritzker plan to deal with that?
He hasn't really said. He continues to be asked about what also it means, because, of course, we have President-elect Trump will soon be in the White House, and what knocks that could mean for the state budget, being that promised grants don't come through or changes, for example, to Medicaid. So there are a whole lot of unknowns. He'll present a budget address next month, and that's when I think we're going to get some of these answers. He's going to have to do something that he hasn't had to do a ton of thus far in his term, and that is saying no. I mean, he's a billionaire. He has not had to ever really rein in the purse strings personally, but that might be something that he's going to do. Particularly, he has said that he doesn't want to focus on new taxes. And frankly, Illinois kind of did a lot of maybe those tax increases, $750 million worth in this current budget. So sort of maybe those easy things are already gone. But he does promise that it'll be balanced. So you have that. But I think you also do have Democrats that are in complete control despite November's election. You've had no change in the dynamic of the legislature. I mean, literally, it is the same. Mm-hmm. And so Democrats call the shots. We do, however, have, as we were talking about, sort of infighting among the governor and the mayor. Yes. There are signs of a schism between the governor and the House Speaker, who thus far been aligned after, during this hemp legislation, the governor upset at the Speaker for not reining in House Democratic legislators for being, what he said, really denigrating and accusing staff of lying, and the governor saying that that's inappropriate. So not sure that that's going to be something that carries over throughout all this session, but it is certainly an inauspicious start.
Oh boy, there's a whole new batch of laws going into effect in 2025 too, Revy. One requires Illinois companies to be more transparent about salaries. Finally.
That's right. So companies with 15 or more employees are going to have to talk about and establish what the pay range is in job openings. And the whole point here is to eliminate bias. So, I mean, for a long, pay equity issues have been going on since the beginning of time. And we have very strong laws, both federal and state laws, about equal pay for equal work. But it still happens. And who are the people that are most victimized by this? Women, women of color, gender, age, racial. All those kinds of groups are discriminated against this way. So as women have been paid less forever, the idea here is to eliminate bias, make sure that whatever the job is, the established pay range is out there to be transparent. And also, all these jobs have to be posted internally for these organizations that have 15 employees or more. So again, that increases, it increases, you know, increases transparency. And you would think that we don't need to do this in 2020. 2025, but it is certainly very important. It also says, by the way, that you cannot ask, it reinforces this idea that you cannot ask about wage history that you've had in jobs that you've had before. Because again, that is something that will, that kind of discrimination that causes people to be underpaid for their jobs
I've
kind of falls
hated
on
that question.
It is illegal.
Low key.
I've always hated that.
So while people may think gender wage gaps are a thing of the past, Reset talked last week with Shamili Majmudar of Women Employed about the issue. Here's what she had to say.
This past year was the first year in 20 years that the gender wage gap actually grew. When you then add in race or age, you actually see it grow even further. And this really adds up. Over a 40-year career, for example, we're looking at a gap that adds up to close to $200,000 all the way to well over $1 million.
And I'm curious, Amanda, I mean, are there parameters on this salary range that gets listed? Because I wonder if a job could put as their description and say the salary is anywhere between $50,000 and $100,000.
I don't know that there are those
people
sort of strict parameters.
People will start getting ridiculous with these ranges.
They might. The argument from advocates is that this is actually something that, although business groups did fight against it by and large, that this is going to be helpful for them too, because then you can better plan and you're having folks in for interviews that already know what range they're looking at, so you don't get to the end of the process and say, oops, I didn't want this job anyway. That doesn't meet my expectations or my reality. So that is a component. I will say I also did speak with the equal pay manager for the State Department of Labor, who said that the goal here is not to be punitive. It's what Ravi talked about in terms of really a goal of transparency. Companies are required to send data to the state that is now being examined to really sort of look at where those equity lines play out. So this is a multi-year process in trying to bring things more equal without being punitive. You can get to that, of course, but that's not the aim.
That's been going on since actually 2022. They've had to share that salary info, not only with the state regulators, but also with the Federal Employment Equity Employment Opportunities Commission, so the EEOC. So the ranges can't be sort of unrealistic.
Okay, well, good.
Oh, we're going to get, 1 to 9 inches of snow tonight, that kind of thing.
Right. All right, so let's not forget, there were a couple of bills that passed in this week's lame duck session. Nader, one's got to do with foster care. Can you give us the details?
Yeah, the bill would reprioritize kin. So family of a child who's going into the foster care system for placement. And there are a lot of studies that show placing foster care children into households of family have much better outcomes. They help them gain more stability. They help them gain more permanence in a permanent home. And so that's one thing. It would make sure that kids are more likely to go into a family's house. The other benefit of this bill, as it's been put, is that these families would become more eligible for funding and for support from the government. Because right now, there's about 10,000 students in DCFS, under DCFS who live with families, but about 60% of them don't get help.
So this would prioritize keeping them with relatives.
It would also help the state right now. The state helps pay for these families to support the children. If it's done more through DCFS, they would be able to bring in federal grants to help pay for that child care.
Mm. Amanda, legislators were clashing over a bill that would make it easier to change one's name. What's going on there?
And so this is done with the intent, backers say, of protecting particularly domestic violence victims or others who maybe undergo some sort of gender change and want to be able to change their name to reflect that. Mm-hmm. Or in the case of domestic violence victims, to be able to, stay away from their abuser and to go undetected. The criticism from opponents is that it will as well allow those who are in the country without a proper paperwork to also be able to change their names and go mm-hmm. undetected by immigration enforcement authorities. And so what it does is you no longer have to be a resident of Illinois for 6 months. You can have that time and then also not publish the name change. Right now, that's something that Illinois has required be put in a newspaper so that if you're changing your name, folks can know about it.
Tell
and you're going to be easier to detect. And so that is the proposal. It is right now, it will be heading to the governor's desk.
One bill introduced this week would change requirements for older drivers, Revy.
That is right. Now, we actually have very strict laws here in Illinois about that. Right now, if you're 79 or 80, you have to get a road test and then and an eye test and all the rest of it. And that road test, you know, behind the wheel. Well, they want to say that when you turn 79 or 80, you got to go to the DMV just for the vision test alone, not necessarily a road test. Later on, when right now, you know, when you're anywhere from 81 to 86 years of age, mm-hmm. you got to take a road test every 2 years.
Right.
Plus that vision test. Now, he wants to kind of loosen, Alexei Giannoulias, the Secretary of State, wants to essentially loosen some of these rules because actually these senior drivers are the safest drivers that are out there.
So he's pushing it to what, 87 years old?
That's right.
Now,
to 87,
right?
Now you've got to be able, you got to go and have a road test. But the thing is that we think about older drivers, what have you. But the fact is that in Illinois last year, drivers over the age of 75 were involved in the lowest number of accidents actually compared to other age groups. So the other thing about the new law is that it allows relatives, though, to go to the state, go to the DMV, and ask the state to step in if they are really worried about their relative who probably shouldn't drive.
Just add quick, sure. Not law yet. This one is a proposal.
It's a proposal.
So
right.
Just putting it out there, if you're elderly, you still have to comply with the more rigorous requirements for now.
Thank you for that. So we talked about schools earlier in the recap, Nader, but I got to put you back in the hot seat because we got this annual report from CPS's Inspector General. It came out with details on hundreds of investigations. I want to start with this finding that families, they're just lying about their income.
Yeah, lying, leaving stuff out. Who's to say?
Lying.
Lying. It's.
I like the indignity.
They're lying.
It's an interesting issue, and this was found to be pretty widespread, and even among CPS staff who have kids in the district. And it has to do with this form where families fill it out every year. They sort of say how much money they make, and it's used to determine whether they'll receive a designation basically of low income. It used to be used to figure out whether students should get free or reduced school lunches.
Right.
But everyone's gotten free school lunches.
And that's
lunches.
Why the district would ask a family to
right.
provide their household income in the first place.
But everyone at CPS has gotten free or reduced school lunches since 2015. This form has continued to be filled out because it has some benefits like figuring out whether schools that have higher shares of students who come from low-income backgrounds should get more funding. It's also used for, you know, fees and things like that to waive them for families.
Mm-hmm. So the CPS Inspector General also wants changes to how high school sports are run. So what's the recommendation there?
Well, there's a pretty big investigation out of Kenwood Academy, one of the bigger name high schools.
The basketball teams,
yeah,
right?
So the former coach, Michael Irvin, the inspector general, found that he helped fraudulently enroll around 17 players to play on his basketball team. This involved students who didn't live in Chicago at all.
Right.
Or they lived in Chicago but weren't in the attendance boundaries in Kenwood. And Kenwood, especially in recent years, has really become a highly sought out school, people trying to move into the attendance boundary to go there. And so the theory is that he helped do this in order to get really good basketball players on the basketball team.
Right. The inspector general also found flaws with ROTC enrollment at some schools. So just quickly remind us what ROTC or Reserve Officers Training Corps is and what's being alleged here specifically.
Yeah, so the junior ROTC is in high schools. It's an Army-led training program to get students ready for a career in the military. And what has happened in the past, this was an investigation done a few years ago, is that many Chicago high schools were automatically enrolling students in this Army program. And kids had no choice. They just got their schedule. It said you're in JROTC.
Mm-hmm.
And it was done by a lot of schools because they didn't want to hire a separate gym teacher, a physical education teacher. And so they put them in this program that counts under CPS. It counts as your physical education requirement towards high school graduation.
Right.
for the most part, that issue was resolved a couple of years ago. There was a Chalkbeat investigation. They're a big education-focused news outlet. And then the inspector general looked into it. They had a lot of findings, and CPS tried to correct them.
Okay.
The investigation this time is that one of those schools just ignored all of that. They continued automatically enrolling students. They even, the share of new students who enrolled in JROTC went up to 96%.
Oh my goodness. So they didn't even
what is the punishment? And what is the punishment here?
Only students in that school who were not automatically enrolled in JROTC were 5 students who are in special education. They were put into a PE class. The inspector general found this. It has improved this school year. That school has, I believe, about 44% of its freshmen in JROTC instead of 96%. And so it's just something that they're going to have to continue monitoring.
Amanda, Lori Lightfoot's name came up in this report too. I mean, what did the inspector general have to say about the former mayor?
Well, so this goes back to the situation that my colleague at WTTW, Heather Sharon, first uncovered, that when she was in her ultimately failed bid for a second term as mayor, had somebody from the campaign sent emails asking for student volunteers that they would get class credit for. That ultimately did not happen, although you did have really a handful of students that did partake and signed non-disclosure agreements without their parents' knowledge. So really all sort of missteps when there has to, of course, be a separation between politics, aka running for mayor and serving as mayor with oversight of the city's school district. Mm-hmm. And so this really came with recommendations for additional ways that the CPS needs to make clear, as you're going to have even more, frankly, opportunities is what this audit really pointed out with an elected school board partially starting, next week, and then completely within a couple years' time, for there to be maybe school board members saying, hey, I've got emails of teachers and CPS families. This seems like a great way to network. And so really just a warning there. And I do want to add that the Lightfoot herself did take umbrage with some of the allegations still and says that she was unaware that this was a lower level staffer.
Right. Well, as in the past, Nader, the largest number of complaints to the CPS Inspector General's office this year, about a quarter of them, they're about just one thing. Talk about that.
Sexual misconduct allegations. And I want to say the number of allegations isn't exactly troubling because it's a very large school system. There's 325,000 students. But there are, among those allegations, some very troubling things. And
we're talking staff on student.
Staff on student, yeah. So
allegedly.
Adult behavior that is troubling with a student. And on the number of allegations, this is something that the Inspector General's office has actually said is a good thing, because back in 2018, there was a Chicago Tribune series called Betrayed. It uncovered widespread mishandling of sexual misconduct in CPS. And once there was more training, once there was more awareness, easier ways for students to complain and raise concerns, allegations started pouring in. And they've sort of stabilized the past few years. And that's what they want, is they want children, if there's something going on with an adult in the school, to speak up so it can be investigated. And the Inspector General's office has control over looking into those cases.
Nope, it's not your imagination. Traffic in Chicago really is that bad. So bad that we tied New York City for the worst traffic in the country and one of the worst in the world. According to data from the analytics firm INRIX, Chicagoans spent an average 102 hours stuck in traffic last year. So I was curious if these findings ring true for our panelists and if they feel like we've got some of the worst traffic on earth. Here's Nader.
The biggest data set that I have is the number of times I get angry and frustrated driving home or anywhere.
Yep.
And it feels like between the hours of, 3 p.m. and 6 p.m., there's nowhere in the city that you're not just going to be standing stuck in traffic. Mm-hmm. We're not even talking about expressways, just going up any old road.
It's so true.
I also say, as one who works odd hours sometimes, well, actually from Monday to Friday, I work sort of from the mid-afternoon till nighttime. Getting on to the Kennedy at, 10:45 in the evening, late at night, and there's a traffic jam to get onto the. Onto the Kennedy is unbelievable.
Even though it's later,
not every
you
night,
used
but
to be able
nights.
To say, okay, just don't drive during rush hour.
We're talking 10:45
no longer
doesn't
hold
matter.
True. It's
1
misery.
1 p.m., 2 p.m.,
no,
3 p.m.
7 p.m., you
misery.
Know, right.
And yeah. This is where I think there are, I mean, there's construction, sure, but then there's the notion that just adding lanes isn't going to solve anything. No. And then you've got to fix public transit, which CTA says it's doing. It's adding lines, but people are still upset about
like
it.
When?
I took
Let's
it here.
Those reversible
there were
lanes
smokers,
on the Kennedy.
Of course, on the train, not ideal.
I mean, hopefully traffic will ease up a bit next week. That's when the express lanes of the Kennedy are scheduled to reopen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those reversibles.
Seems like forever,
right.
Doesn't it? We discussed this concept.
Except the DNC.
Yeah, except the DNC. We discussed the concept of congestion pricing in Chicago on reset yesterday, of course, on the heels of everything changing over in New York City. So anyone wants to listen to that conversation, it's delightful, but I'm biased. Catch up on the Reset podcast, which is available wherever you get your pods. So you mentioned the CTA briefly there, Amanda. They made a change of their own recently. The transit agency suspended its X social media account, and now they're encouraging riders to just sign up for our text messages.
Yeah, and so there is frustration about that. I would say this doesn't seem as if it is. I mean, they are still posting about this. It's not as if they're going into, you know, a hole and not sharing information.
Okay.
It's just that they're not sharing it on a platform that is used by a lot of people still and that is very accessible
and
easy.
And they haven't said why they've left, but
yes.
We know that people have been leaving in the millions. Right.
People have been leaving X, formerly Twitter.
Yep.
There are
ever since Elon Musk
sure.
bought the platform back in 2022.
But so there's frustration. I would say that I don't know. I do rely on the Twitter feed. Actually, I used to call it Twitter. I'm sorry, X.
Yeah.
Just not my jam.
It was quite helpful. I mean, what do you think?
It has been helpful.
What do you think of the CTA's decision, Nader?
Well, I think. Twitter, I'm just going to keep calling it Twitter if yes. that's okay. Twitter has become less useful for news and updates. Mm-hmm. They've changed their algorithms. I mean, we've even seen it this week with the wildfires in LA.
Yeah.
It's been hard to get verified information before you have to go through dozens of whatever junk posts. And so I can understand it, but it is, if there is an account that gives regular updates and you can set notifications for that, it is a pretty easy and accessible way to get information. So I can see the frustration.
Well, speaking of verified information, this week Meta announced that it would end fact-checking on Facebook and Instagram. What are your thoughts, Revy?
Well, they're essentially
as you sit here with Meta glasses on.
I do have them on, actually. And they're pretty cool. I'm still
and
getting
I was none
used
the wiser.
Them.
They just looked
really?
Like glasses.
I was wondering why they were lighting up and looking at me.
They're wayfarers.
Seen that? I might have had questions.
They're wayfarers. But if I take a picture or if I go live to Instagram or anything, you'll see a little light come on. And I should warn you about that before. But anyway.
But now we can't fact check what you're
No. So yeah, to your point, they want to do... Right, so you have to decide whether we're credible here or not. But that's that whole kind of crowdsourcing way of looking for what is the truth, what is reliable. I have to agree with you on a personal level that X, Twitter, just as a source of information in a quick moment, isn't nearly as effective, certainly to me personally, as it has been before. They want to say, okay, no more fact-checking because the fact-checkers have shown bias at times, mm-hmm. and they're going to go to essentially a crowdsourcing way community notes of saying, well, you know what you just said over there? That wasn't correct. Or like when you corrected me about the law about older drivers, that kind of thing, and allow that sort of ground up way of ensuring accuracy. And so what do I think of it? I'm a journalist. Nobody cares what I think of it. But what I think is interesting is that it's sort of aping what a lot of other Silicon Valley companies are doing, which is making sure that they're on the right side of whatever the politics
is. There's a lot of genuflecting going on.
Yeah.
There's a lot of talk about the timing too, Amanda, and the real motives here being that we've got President-elect Trump on his way in office. And is this to appease him? I've seen a lot of conversation about that. Have you?
Yeah, there's a lot of conversation about that. And I think those are very fair questions to ask at this point, given that there's just sort of this whole sort of Silicon Valley mode of, oh gosh, we'd better be careful and kiss some butt is really what it appears to be looking like. There are, I think, very fair questions about how to use fact-checking. And really, it's on users and individuals. And it's getting increasingly difficult when you have platforms that are backing away from this, and there's more and more content out there. But to check your information, and that's where we all work for really great trusted news organizations. You have journalists that are doing that work.
You can rely on
us. Shout out. Check out WTW. Right.
But whether it's Meta Glasses or Instagram, or you're getting things off of a website from a company, what have you, you've got to always know that who you're talking to, what the sources are real, and they're authentic, and they're not biased. And that's what we do. That's what we do every day anyways, right?
That's our jobs. Yeah. All right, switching gears. Chicago's football season, it's come to a pretty disappointing end. And now comes the process of finding a new coach. So the Bears have been interviewing former coaches for the Tennessee Titans and Seattle Seahawks and other candidates. I mean, how appealing do you think the Bears are as a franchise now?
They are one of the founding franchises. They'll always be
so
appealing.
So to a prospective coach, you're like, I want to work there.
Absolutely.
Right?
Okay. And they've got good draft capital. They've got some money. I'm not going to talk about the family and the family dynamics. But the fact is, it should be a place that people want to go. And I personally, if I can just say right now, would like to see a leader of men. Ryan Poles, the general manager, the other day in the year-end review said, we want to find people who understand competition. Like, this is the NFL. That competitive fire has to be there on every play, every down, helping your teammates, all that other stuff. And that's what can happen when you got a dick cut type of guy.
So I want to squeeze this in while we're on the topic of sports, because Michael Jordan is coming to mind. And this is because the commercial real estate exec who paid top dollar for Jordan's Highland Park mansion, he's now offering co-ownership shares in the home. And get this, all you got to do is cough up $1 million.
That's all.
And among other perks, you and your guests would get exclusive access to the home for the same week every year. Any takers?
It's a timeshare.
It is.
Basically.
Why not just Airbnb it to the wealthy set? I don't know.
I don't know. Is there some buyer's remorse thing?
I mean, he got it at a good deal, right?
Yeah.
Still far more than I can even dream of.
Years.
I spent my $1 million last week. I'm all out.
Fresh out. Anyway.
I don't think I'll be able to.
We got to wrap here, but I do want to squeeze in some good news for bird lovers. The building just a few steps from Soldier Field, McCormick Place, it's seen a 95% decrease in bird collisions.
Hooray.
Since spending over $1 million to install these bird safe film over the windows last year. So this is according to data from the Field Museum. So that is good news. We love hearing that. Our thanks to Revy Beishwal, Amanda Vinicky, and Nader Issa. Have a great weekend, everyone. This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Meha Ahmed and mixed by Ari Mejia. Every Friday, we bring you a roundup of the week's biggest news stories to keep you in the know. To make sure that you never miss one of our weekly recaps or any of the conversations we have throughout the week, make sure to subscribe to our podcast or find us at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Have a great weekend.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.